Welcome to the Muse Dreams Podcast, a place to discover how to bring your art out of hiding or to the next level. I'm your host, Mia Walters. I'm an artist, the creator of the Muse Activation Method, and a certified active dreaming and intentional creativity teacher. I will be your guide on this adventure to awaken your creative inspiration at the source. Hello and welcome back, friend. Today in the studio, I have a very special guest, Tom Davis. He's a writer and a game developer focused on immersive storytelling. His projects combine fantasy fiction with original tabletop RPG systems. He's especially interested in how mechanics shape narrative and character choice. Welcome, Tom.
Wow, thank you. I sound so amazing.
You are amazing. tell us, you're currently writing a book,
yeah.
Filner's Bane.
Yes.
Can you give us a short summary of the premise of the book? What is it about?
Oh, my gosh. Well, it's sort of a, not one book, but three. It's like a, so it's a fantasy, high concept fantasy, but it's got your traditional stuff in there that you might like dragons and wars, and there's betrayals and allegiances and wizards taking over the world. And the story basically follows our main protagonist. I'll make it plural now, I guess. I'm still writing this thing. But Filner is a product of an affair between an elven king, but you don't know that yet. Shh, ooh, spoiler alert. But it's...
Oh, no.
Yeah, and you're fine. But it's he's basically a bastard orphan that's basically been dismissed. In the greater scheme of the world, it's a harsh world. It's still got a lot of power dynamics in it, and people are mean and trying to always oppress each other constantly. You know, so it's just like real world, but with swords and dragons. And Filner, by the end of the whole thing, he ends up saving the entire world. So this discarded person ends up through the course of the moral lessons and the moral journey of the all the different things, you know, ends up being what saves the world. So that's the arc of it. But it's sort of like Game of Thrones meets Lord of the Rings meets Conan the Barbarian. So if you're into those things, especially if you wish there was a book that wrapped all three of those things up into one, buy my book.
Speaking of, tell us a little bit about some of your influences and kind of where, I guess, your origin story is as a writer.
Yeah. When I was in middle school, I had a friend, Phil. Hello, Phil, if you're out there watching this. I hope you are.
Hey, Phil.
Yeah, hey, Phil. we should grab dinner or something sometime. Okay, so... yeah, it was fun going to Phil's house because he had the coolest record player. It had these big speakers on it, and he had all the cool music. And he also had these real battle-ready swords, which I'd only read about in books. And I thought, that's crazy that these things actually exist. And he had the books. He had the Conan books. So he basically talked about them, and I was like, that sounds interesting. And so I read them, and I was blown away because my introduction to really reading was that. That was it. I didn't read any stuff from school first that said, you know, check out How to Kill a Mockingbird or anything like that yet. My first introduction reading was Conan the Barbarian beheading people. And and I just was like, this is incredible. And because he's such a vivid, energetic writer at that. So my first impression of writing was high energy, high visual impact, right? Fast pace, like, because he was a Pulp Fiction writer. And so he really got me into it. And then when I read all of those books, the next best thing I had was Michael Moorcock's Elric of Melbourne, in The Eternal Champions, and I read all that. And then that was over with, and then there was nothing else like that to read. And Lord of the Rings, of course, but I didn't actually get through all that. I kind of got bored with it, because
I feel like J.R.R. Tolkien is more the adult Tom Davis. Yes. Now that you're revisiting all of that versus the...
Thanks for the save.
10-year-old Tom Davis.
Thanks for the save.
Yeah.
Because that's exactly right. I was so bored. Like, the story, whatever. I just want to see someone get in a fight, you know. And so, but yeah, he... when I was when I ran out of all that stuff, there was no more content. And what do you do when you're dying for that content and there's none? You create it. And so I just tried mimicking the writing that I had in front of me, and I didn't take it out and copy it, but I was like just my own stories and in that style. And I got sort of popular at school by writing these stories at school, and that's sort of how I got into it. And I liked everyone's reaction when I read them, and I just seemed like something I was good at.
Isn't there a saying that it says, write the book that you want to read, or something
like
that?
Yeah, yeah, that's what I do.
Yeah.
I write what I wish I could read.
Yeah.
Because then it's fun. So, and many times when I'm writing, I follow that. So, like, if I'm writing something and I've set this thing up and I'm like, I'm bored writing this at this point. I'm like, well, then I'd be bored reading it. And so I just have a change happen. And I'm like, then it goes here, you know, and I do that stuff all the time.
Yeah, you can do that in your game, which probably links into a little bit of your writer's origin story is the
true.
Games,
that's
right?
True, yeah. Yep.
Can you take us into the Wayback Machine on that?
I don't know if we have one that goes that far back.
The hot tub time machine? Yeah.
It only goes back 88 years. I'm 144 years old. No, no, I just look 144. I'm actually not. Yeah, so there was... once I got done writing stuff, which I never really got done writing stuff, but I found Dungeons & Dragons back in the day, and I thought... Like, you know, like we're not just writing a story and reading it, we're living it. Like, are you kidding me? This is made for me. I can write this stuff on the fly as an experience, as a book. You can experience real time. And I became a game master, like, instantly. And I would just create these worlds. And I had people who were really into playing with me in the games because I had such a good imagination. Here's a dungeon we're going to crawl through. Like, I would set up like this thing that needed to be corrected, or this goal that was difficult to get to. I thought of everything in terms of story, and then there was difficulty. And a little quick side story, but I had one of my good friends who ended up playing with me for years and thought I was the best game master in the whole world. When we first met, he hated my guts because he showed up at our first session with, okay, I have all this magic stuff, and I have this sword that kills everything, I got this armor that protects me for everything, and anyway, this is the stuff I come with. And I'm like, yeah, you lost it all. It's gone. And he's like, you can't do that. And I'm like, it's in the name, dude. Game Master. And he said, I can absolutely do that. You can't come in that power. You can't come in that powerful. And he hated me. Everything was a struggle in the game. He's like, he's used to killing everything, and so now he has to really think about what he's doing. And after about, I don't know, 2 or 3 weeks, he's like, I'm having so much fun. Like, I really have to think and try, and what I do matters in the game, as opposed to I'm just used to kill. You're the best game master ever. And I'm like, okay. But yeah, so Filner was a character, and so I used him as my stand-in character for the game, and the books came out of that, and then the game informs the books, and what we play comes into the games, and they've been feeding each other and informing each other this whole time. So they're very integrated together.
Nice. I kind of feel like Conan the Barbarian and Robert E. Howard were playing Dungeons and Dragons in the back of your mind a little bit.
If D&D was around when he was, you know, he'd be playing that.
Oh, he would have. He
would take a 20-sided dice for Conan and write a 20 on every side. Oh, a natural 20 every time.
Aw. So, speaking of Robert E. Howard.
Yeah.
Can you tell the story of kind of the creative tools that you've recent, and this is recent, but it's also not recent. So tell us about that. I guess you can take it away with that. What okay. The materials in your creative process and all of that stuff, because I just want people to hear about it because I feel like it's extremely unique in this world now where there's computers and AI and all of that.
Oh gosh, yeah, don't.
So
we should talk about that.
Yeah, we will. But I just want everyone to hear about what you're doing with that, because particularly the writers who might be experiencing some writer's block or, you know, even block as far as like even getting started with a story, that kind of thing.
Oh boy. So, gosh, there's so much there. Robert E. Howard, I started reading about Robert E. Howard, and not just that he wrote the Conan books, but I started learning about the author who wrote the Conan books. And it's a really interesting, weird, baffling, sad story, because he was very depressed. He ended up dying suicide when he was 30 years old. He was born in, I think, 1906 and died in 1936 by his own hand. And he, I think, looked at his therapy was writing. And I think many people who write or write music or whatever, I think it is the same. I think they exercise their demons through their stories or their music. And I think he did that in excess, predominantly because there was no mental care help for him in Cross Plains, Texas in 1917 or whatever. So he was very, very much a smart person. He was very much a well-read person for being in Cross Plains, Texas, where and he basically made a living and writing these stories. And I saw the more and I saw his house where he wrote them and stuff. And one of the things I saw was this typewriter, and I thought, man, that's cool. And as I was reading, he's like, yeah, he wrote on a Underwood number 5, and I was like, what the hell is that? So I went and looked, and I'm like, oh, you can still get those. You can actually buy those. Not new, of course, but I went on a Facebook Marketplace, and I found some. And my lovely sweetheart for Christmas got me one off of Facebook Marketplace. And we looked together, and I ended up buying one of my own, which was a mistake. And this other guy wouldn't get back to me ever. Like, he just was never calling me back. And I thought, man, I don't know. There's something about that particular one, that particular typewriter. And so we stayed with it, and he finally got back to me after we bought the other one. And he came and got it, and he said it was a 1920 model. And I was like, the one Robert E. Howard wrote on was a 1925, so that's close enough. And I got it home, checked the serial number, and it was incorrect. It was not a 1920s model. It was it was made in March of 1917, which was the same year my dad was born and same month my dad was born, who was my childhood hero in real life. And never met anyone like him. I doubt I ever will again. Robert E. Howard was my writing hero. My father was my real hero. And now I have this typewriter that Robert E. Howard used that was minted the same birthday as my dad, all in one machine. And I'm writing about heroes. So I feel like everything that comes off that typewriter comes with the infusion of that and is somehow has to be worthy of that.
Nice.
And so it's been what I thought would just be a fun item to have, I got a typewriter, has actually turned out to really change my writing process quite a bit. So,
well, before that, you were struggling with, you know, you're always kind of searching for this perfect environment or time of day or situation. And it was very fragile, I felt like, and elusive.
That is true.
And then I felt like when you got this typewriter, that really changed. And it's been ever since, like, I mean, I know there's a number of other factors, but I think the typewriter has a lot to do with that. Can you tell us about your writing process a little bit with the typewriter and what you've been doing with that?
Yeah, it is very different. And with if you took my laptop and said, what was the most used key on my laptop? It's the backspace key. So I'd write and backspace, write and backspace, write and backspace. And there's no backspace on a typewriter. So you actually have to, I would sort of kind of go with the flow on the laptop and just say, this. And then, that wasn't so good. Let me backspace. More like this. Like, that's a little better. And then I sort of just kind of creep my way through. And I end up taking all day for a page, right? And the page, and at the end of the day, it's so early in the story, you don't even know if that page is any good or not. Yet I'm judging the hell out of it. So I was sort of stuck in that. And so what I do now, I mean, there's some preparation steps. I can talk about those if you want. But the typewriter, what it brings to it is that you've got to, there's no backspace. So you got to think about what you want to say in advance. And there is no underscore or, you know, right click and check your thesaurus. You got to know the words. And you got to use your brain, basically. And so I actually went out and I bought a paperback thesaurus and dictionary like I used to have in middle school when I would write. And I don't look stuff up on the internet anymore. Like, I just look at the book, and if I stumble with a word, and I'd use that. And it's increasing my vocabulary, my word usage. And when you're writing, you have to write with intention. So you have to actually stop and think about what you want to write, because, you know, you have to think about how you want to construct your paragraphs. So it just slows everything down. And I learned that Tolkien used to do this too. He would agonize over, well, he probably didn't agonize. He probably agonized automatically from experience, automatically without being conscious he agonized over it. But his sentence structure and paragraph structure is so precise compared to, and so is Robert E. Howard, so precise that it's not an accident. They thought about this stuff. And so when you're writing super fast, just getting your stuff out, you don't have time to think about that stuff. So that's one way it improved it. I actually think about, what is the best sentence structure? Is it subject verb? Do I want to put some adverbs in, or do I want to make it an active verb? Or I actually think about this stuff now as I'm writing. So it's made the writing more paceable, right? So if I need to get through something quick, I just got a subject and a verb, done. He quit, you know, he fell, right? It's powerful. It's done. He fell. It's that fast, you know. But the other way that it helps is, and I think this is where I need almost more help, was because there is no backspace key, you see all your mistakes and you got to just let them go. You got to let it go. This is your first draft. I do all my first draft work on the typewriter. And you just got to look at the page and see the strike throughs or see the bad spelling, and you got to let it go. And that's been the hardest thing for me that blocked me as a writer, was not being able to let stuff go. That's why I would work all day and have a page. And now I crank out 5 or 6, mistakes and all. And I'm learning to accept them, because it's not supposed to be perfect the first time through.
Absolutely. And I feel like with so many tools that are supposed to help us, oftentimes I think they bypass a lot of the creative process. They dumb us down almost. Yeah. Like, speaking of like AI and that kind of thing, you can't use AI. You can speak to the whole AI debate. But it just really makes you dive deep into your own creativity with it versus using anything else to help you with that.
Yeah. You need to know that AI has no context, right? Whenever I get writer's block or get stuck, before would go to AI and say, what are some ways? But it's just going to regurgitate things other people have said, and everything it comes up with is cheesy and no good. I haven't been impressed by anything where I'm like, tell me how to get out of this situation, or how would you frame this conflict, and been like, wow, that's actually pretty good. I haven't done that once. So what I have done, though, is just when I've gotten stuck, is I just dig in, and I'm like, the characters are stuck. It's not me. Or the story's stuck. It's not me. And I got to get out of this. I can't just walk away, and this can't be where the story ends. And so you work your way out of it. And how would? And one of the techniques I used this in management when I was there, when someone would give me an impossible project, and they're like, Tom, we have to get this thing done in 6 months with brand new people, and it's a 9-month project, and that's it. That's what you get. That's what you get. And everyone on the team would say, there's no way. And I said, if we were to get it done in 6 months, how would it happen? And then people would be like, well, we'd have to skip this step and do that. And I'm like, okay, I think we got a plan now. So, and we got it done.
Force parameters.
Right. And so I look at that like, well, if I got to get out of this jam, how would I do it? And what I found is by forcing myself through that, I end up with a much better product. And so some of the better sequences, some of the better, more deeper writing that I have has come from those moments where I thought it was the worst and I wanted to give up on it. And I hit a limit and I didn't know how to get past it. I didn't know how to write it. I didn't know what they were going to do. And because I worked through it, I enriched it so much that it's some of the best work.
So what, at the current stage of your book and mm-hmm. and the scenes that you have, what is your favorite scene in the book right now that you can just give us a little summary about and tell us about?
Favorite scene in the whole book.
That's the favorite scene in the book as it's written right now. And I guess, and why?
Okay. I don't know. There's a couple.
Gotta pick one.
Oh, God. All right.
And it can change tomorrow. It's okay. Oh, you won't betray your other scene.
Oh, they're so good, though. All right. Favorite scene. Okay, I guess one of the favorite scenes is comes out of a dark moment. Our character Filner has a basically captured a, for lack of a better word, a terrorist who's gone around and hurt a bunch of innocent people, and the authorities have done nothing about it. There's some political thing going on where they're allowed to hurt people with impunity and nothing will happen with them. And Filner is like, that's a no-go for me. It's not even his country where this is happening. He just heard about it. He went over there and said, that's a no-go. You can't do that. So he set a trap and caught the guy and then revisited everything he did, that villain did on all these innocent people. He revisited all those things onto him. So every mean thing he ever did to hurt someone, Filner delivered all that back onto him, which nearly kills him. But part of the setup of it is there's a little boy named Josiah who Filner hired to let him know when the bad guy got into town, give him a heads up. And then when he does, to tell the bad guy, where to go, like, I know where you should go. And then for that, he was going to pay him some coin and stuff. And Josiah's probably got to be 10 years old, and he's an orphan. And so Filner's got a little soft spot for him for that, I think. And Josiah does just that. But unfortunately, when he gets there and meets the bad guy treats Josiah poorly and he kicks him and knocks out a tooth. And he's mean. He's a mean person. And it angers Filner that happened. So Filner captures this guy and tells Josiah, he actually pays someone to take Josiah far away because he knows what's about to happen. And he does, but Josiah sneaks back and observes Filner doing all this stuff to this guy, which is completely inappropriate for adults, much less a 10-year-old. But there was a scene in there where, because one of the lines Josiah had at the beginning of this was like when the guy kicked him, and he's like, I'm just a boy. And Josiah said, is nothing right in this world? Is nothing right? And it just is such a deep line, and it really gets to me. That's his worldview at that point. Like, is nothing right? And so Filner, as a part of his revisiting his crimes upon that guy, one of the things he does is take his own boot and, knocks out a tooth. And then when he meets Josiah again, he goes, I got something for you. He gives him the tooth.
Oh, my gosh.
So it's sort of brutal, right? It's sort of brutal. But while Josiah is watching that scene, when Filner's like, oh, yeah, there's one more thing I've got to take care of right here. You took Jesse's tooth. That's not okay. And Jesse, in that moment, watching all that, instead of feeling vile disgust, he actually felt loved. He felt protected. And it's the first time anyone's ever stood up for him. Wow. And so later when Filner, choking me up, later when Filner, and Filner's been mean to this guy, right? So he's covered in blood, right? And he meets the boy and to give the rest of the money, and inside the bag of money, there's some teeth. And he goes, those are for you. You know, I made sure that he paid you back too. And wow. Josiah knows it. And Josiah hugs him. And Filner blurts out, I love you, little man. But he didn't mean to. He's never said that to anyone before. And then, so it's this really intense hug. And then when Josiah pulls away, because he'd been crying, his face is covered in blood.
Oh, no.
And Filner looks down at him and is like, you got a little something on you. You might just wash up, okay? He's like, okay. You know, and it's just this weird irony of, like, he's never felt more loved, but he's covered in this.
It's such a, like, twisted way.
It's such a weird thing, like, and but it's just that whole awkwardness of you got a little something. It's like all, well, anyway, go wash up, you know? Sorry about that, you know.
How do you stay grounded when working with such intense material like that? Because I know this book has got a lot of, like, really gritty, and there's some violence kind of going back to some of your heroes and, you know, that kind of genre where I think, you know, that's something that people would need to know before reading it, for one. But how do you stay grounded? How do you not let that get to you?
Well, because I try to stay grounded in the real world. And in the real world, stuff like that happens. And you know what else happens in the real world? Really insanely beautiful stuff, too. And amazing compassion. Amazing accomplishments. And I think from my own life, I experienced both sides of that equation. Mm-hmm. I was Filner. I was Josiah, you know, in that regard. And I had people that were actively trying to kill me, you know, when I was a little kid, basically, like, just so abusive. Like, they didn't, if I accidentally died, it's not like they would have cared that much. And then I had my dad rescue me from that, thus my hero, and risked everything to make sure I grew up okay. Both things were true.
Yeah.
The worst of the worst and the best of the best, all in, you know, one small 10-year lifespan of time. Like, I just developed this appreciation for, yeah, stuff happens. But if you're going to accept that, you got to also accept that good stuff happens. And so I think it's also true that if you got to accept good stuff happens, you got to accept bad stuff happens too. Yeah. And that way you appreciate the good stuff. And so to me, it's, you know, that's how I stay grounded. I don't obsess about violence. I don't go out and wish violence on people. I'm very peaceful and passive myself for the most part. I don't like it. You know, I don't, but it's just a reality. And so I try to write with reality. And I think that's probably how I do it.
What do you think the biggest enemy of creativity is?
Of creativity?
Yeah, I mean, thinking about all of you, you're kind of a multi-hyphenate creative with music and writing and all the things that you do. And this podcast is all about kind of taking your creativity, your art to the next level, take it out of hiding. And I think there can be, speaking of enemies, can be enemies to that.
There
and
is.
Just wondering what you think the biggest enemy of that is.
I think it's judgment and self-doubt. Mm-hmm. And I think when I was a kid writing, I actually have all that writing that I did when I was in middle school.
That's amazing that you've kept that all this years.
School. And I talk about it like I was some great writer. People loved me reading it to them when I wrote it. And that is not a falsehood. That is true. people would meet me after school and say, what'd you write today? And I had like six or seven people at the end of school every day, and I'd read them what I wrote in class throughout the day, and they were just amazed. And I was like, man, I'm really good. You read that now, it's complete garbage, right? It's like when a 10-year-old wrote this. It's terrible. But it was also like immature boys were listening to it, so their standard was also pretty low, so it matched out, you know? And I think that standard thing is a killer for a lot of people, because I was really excited about writing. I didn't think about, am I doing it right or wrong, or is there a craft to it, or am I as good as Robert E. Howard, or am I as good as someone else my age, or is someone my age better? Like, I didn't even think about it. I just enjoyed the process, and I was prolific. I wrote so much, I wore out every notebook I ever got. I wrecked my dad's typewriter because I used it so much, and he was so cheap, he refused to buy another ribbon, and I didn't know how to get a ribbon. And so I just would soak the ribbon in a little bit of water sometimes to try to revive it, and that didn't work so good. And I would just, eventually I'd pound so hard on it that I would cut the letters out of the paper like Braille so I'd have a story. Those are the people who love to write. And if you're that desperate where you just type on blank paper just to punch holes in the paper, so, I mean, that's pretty desperate. And then I started learning that there's a craft, like when people start saying, well, what's the crucible? And I'm like, what's that? And I'm like, well, why don't the hero and the villain just agree that it's not worth it and go their separate ways? And I'm like, I don't know. And they're like, that's the crucible. There has to be something forcing the conflict. And I'm like, I don't know. What's the character arc? What is that? You know, like, does he have to grow? You know, like, why is that important? And then I started to realize, I don't know what the hell I'm doing. And I started second guessing everything's got to have a point now. And I don't know what the point is or how to get there. And so I quit writing. And I think it just shut me down. It made me feel, honestly, like before I applied that, I felt gifted. And after just a short exposure to that, I felt ridiculous. I felt silly for even thinking I should try it.
Wow.
That's how powerful. I think that's a big killer. And the problem, too, is when we try to do something like write, do music or sing or dance or do anything, we look at the people that inspire us, right? We look at the Robert E. Howards. We look at the whatevers. And we look at ourselves and we compare. And
Comparison, it's
terrible, because what you need to do is compare 10-year-old Tom Davis to 10-year-old Robert E. Howard. That's a fair comparison.
Or not compare at all.
Well, correct. But if you're gonna, don't compare yourself with the finished damn product.
Right.
And you at the beginning.
The person who's worked at their craft. Because you don't see that in, like, the glossy social media posts that people put out. The grit and the, like, 100 stories to get to the good one, because you've honed the craft.
Right.
And maybe taking the questions about, you know, what is the crucible, what is the character's arc or whatever, and taking that as part of honing the craft and learning. And I think, of course, eventually you did get to that point.
I'm getting there.
Yeah.
I'm still not there. I think once I finish an entire work and it's looked at as respectable.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I don't expect people to look at it and go, wow, that's genius. My dream is that if, like, well, probably Tolkien's a bit of a reach, but if Robert E. Howard or Moorcock or someone could come in and read my stuff and go, eh, it's not bad. Be like, yes! You know, like, bam, for my first work, like, yes! So, you're right. You're absolutely right. But that's, I don't know. Like, I just wish that someone had told me, or I knew somehow, because I wasted so many years not writing this story. I only picked it really back up again this past December.
Yeah.
Really.
Well, somebody who might be listening, tell them what they need to hear. What would have served you back when you were, I guess, quitting or thinking those, letting the inner critic kind of devour your creativity at that time?
I guess two things. One, just write, or just sing, or just don't. It doesn't have to have a purpose right now. It doesn't have to fulfill anything right now. All you're doing is getting in touch with that and enjoying it. And that's good enough right now. It doesn't have to go anywhere right now. Mm. And if you really want it to go somewhere, then I would tell you that be careful how you judge yourself, because like we just said, my guitar heroes, I got B.B. King. I love B.B. King. And he's one of the best blues guitar players out there. People, I think that's a pretty honest title he's earned. Most people would acknowledge that. But if you listened to him talk, B.B. King, and he would say, I got diabetes. His hands are the size of hams. And he goes, I can't play guitar very well. I never could play very well. And he goes, it was always so frustrating because I'd hear all these guitar players really burning up the fretboard and I can't play. And it really was hard because I wanted to play. And he wanted to give up a lot, but it was just, he loved playing. He did the first thing. I just couldn't keep playing. And then one day he just decided, I can't play as many notes as everyone else can. So I got to make every note I play count. Mm. And he's developed like a definitive style that has made him, he's gone from someone who doesn't even think he can play guitar to one of the best well-renowned like definitions secured in the annuals of blues history forevermore as one of the best guitar players that ever lived. Mm. So I would say, just because you can't see someone else's suffering or, see that Robert E. Howard, after he died, he had a massive chest where he saved all his rejections. There were more rejections than published works. No one sees that.
Yeah.
And don't judge yourself on what someone else does, period, because you don't know the whole story. And just learn what you can and just be fearless with it, because you're the master of that world you create. And someone can't say, well, his hair should have been blue or he should have had an axe instead of a sword. They don't know that. That's your domain. You get to say that. You're the expert in this world. And so grow with that. And just, that's what I would have wished I could have told myself. And maybe I would have not been so scared of it.
Well, thank you for that. That's very much words of wisdom. And hopefully, maybe somebody out there will hear it and they will keep creating. They won't let anything that's discouraged them bring that to, a grinding halt, which I feel like a lot of creative people have, they've heard some criticism or, who do you think you are and all of that kind of stuff. And it stops them.
Yeah.
It's one of my missions in the world is to help encourage people to be creative, even if it's bad art or whatever the case may be, for their own expression because the world needs that.
What would you have gone back and told 10-year-old Tommy or 15-year-old Tommy?
I would have told him how amazing that is, that he's a writer and getting better every day, and I would have encouraged him to keep going, and essentially that. And if there was any doubt that he wasn't good, that it was okay to not write a bad story, just keep going, because enough stories written, there's going to be a story that you will yourself, and that's who matters, deem as a good story. And I just really feel like it's okay to make bad art, mm-hmm. because it's the path that will lead you to the art that you feel proud of. And I think that's what I'd say.
It's funny, Brandon Sanderson, I started getting into watching a lot of his stuff too, and it was really, really helpful at first. And then, Brandon, if you're watching this, it was very helpful. I learned a lot. very grateful. You're super talented. Love you. Let's do lunch. Okay. So, one of the things I really loved about what he said was, write 6 novels.
Yeah.
And people are like, what do you mean? I'm trying to write one novel.
I'm trying to write one novel.
He's like, no, the first 6 are just going to suck. Don't even get your hopes up. Don't write your first. It was so funny. I'm going to pull this out and I'm going to save it because he described me to a T. He goes, don't take your childhood fantasy trilogy that is your heart and soul and your passion project and nurse it along for 40 years while you figure out how to write it. And I was just like, because you'll never write it. You'll be stuck.
Oh my God.
And I'm just like, oh, this hurts to hear that this is so assignable to me. But he said, put that aside and go write 6 novels. They're not going to be good, so don't even worry about it. But what you're going to learn in doing that is how to make the next ones great. But you're never going to start great. That does not happen with people.
I don't know. I got to kind of disagree. There's a lot of writers out there who
there's so few,
had
though.
A great first novel. Well,
you're looking at one, obviously, but...
I mean, that's
statistically
true, Brandon.
You shouldn't bank on it.
It's okay to take your passion project to completion because I feel like that's a little more important than it being so perfect. And you know what? It's 2026. You can rewrite it someday if you really want to and make it a new edition.
But hopefully you'll write more and better and different stuff, too. I mean, that's the point. You'll grow. And, I may write more Filner stuff or I may get into science fiction. I got a lot of stories that I want to tell.
You have a lot of amazing stories, and I hope you keep writing. And where can people find you to follow you on this writing adventure?
So right now... I have entrusted my whole online presence to Substack.
Okay.
So you can go to filnersbane.substack.com. Filner, FILNERSBANE.substack.com. And you can sign up for free. I do preview chapters for free. So as I write them, I put them out there. And they're just for you to enjoy. So you can go check them out and follow it. And if you feel like contributing to the project, do that. And as I get further along with, the different novels, and I plan on offering a lot of other materials too. Like there's world maps and artifacts from the story that's coming. There's going to be the role-playing game itself, which is probably about 60% done in development.
Well, and you're going to probably be needing some people to help playtest that game.
Yeah, absolutely. We've been playtesting it for 6 months, and it is the funnest role-playing game I've ever played in my life. And everyone that's playing it is in love with it because invariably, at least once a night when we play, we're yelling at the dice. Like, we're so impassioned. Because we earned that dice roll. It wasn't like, oh, I rolled a 20. How much skill did that take? So you got a 1 in 5 chance to, you got a 5% chance to do that. So, but to set up the agency that I give characters in the game, like wizards can share power or they can take power from each other. Like there's a lot of tactical things you can do.
Sounds like storytelling.
That's the thing. It's immersively narrative because you get to participate in what your character does as opposed to just rolling dice. So when stuff pays off, it's deeply rewarding. And so people, we yell and scream at the table and we have a great time. So, but yeah, we're going to need play testers for sure. So if you're interested, hit me up on Substack. And we're going to need beta readers and people to give feedback on the stories that come out as well. So I really welcome all the feedback if anyone has any. So I appreciate all that.
Well, thank you so much for sharing your process and kind of all of the things behind, the scenes with your book writing.
Thank you for having me here.
Yeah, I know it's going to help a lot of people. And we'll definitely have you back on because I know the kind of seeing this in its earlier stages, hearing about your kind of analog process, people are going to want to see the end result. So I'll have you back on.
We'll see how the ratings go first for this episode. Then you can decide later.
Yeah. And thank you for being here and listening as always. And yeah, keep creating.
Thank you so much for listening to the Muse Dreams podcast. Follow us on your favorite social media at Muse Dreams Art and on our website at musedreams.com for updates, behind the scenes content, and to sign up for the Muse Letter and more. If you have questions or show topics, I'd love to hear your thoughts and ideas, so feel free to reach out and connect. Muse Dreams, a podcast for artists, dreamers, and spiritual seekers on the path of creative discovery.